called Linguistic Archive.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. But before I get into today's program, I thought I should mention that I know from my email that there are a lot of regulars who stop by the salon each week, but who never have used any of the psychedelic medicines that are talked about here in the salon from time to time. But since I can't personally respond to each of you, I want you to know that, as I've said on more than one occasion, it isn't the substances that make a person psychedelic. It's your thinking that makes all the difference here. And as you know, the word psychedelic literally means mind manifesting. So one way to think of it is that a psychedelic person is one who is interested in the manifestation of their own mind in a three-dimensional universe that also appears to be connected to time in some way. My guess is that just having the urge to listen to the beginning of this podcast, whether or not a person hangs around and comes back each week, just by checking out the Psychedelic Salon, in my humble opinion at least, makes you psychedelic. And I guess for you bloggers who have fun flaming me for my long-winded introductions, well, hey, I see what you mean. And so moving on, from what I gather, both from email and in listening to some of the podcasts on the Cannabis Podcast Network, there are a lot of conversations taking place around the subject of free will. And as I think I've mentioned before, that is also a topic that Mary C. and I have spent a great deal of time discussing, sometimes changing our opinions one way or another and then back again. But hey, it's a ticklish topic to be sure, and it also comes up in today's talk by Susan Blackmore. Now, I won't bother you with all of the little details about this story, but during the past 8 days, Susan's name has come up in a wide variety of ways and from several completely different directions. So, as I was filing some CDs of the Mind States conferences that JT had sent me, I noticed Susan's talk on the top of the stack, and after having her name come up in so many different ways in the past few days, well, there really wasn't any decision left for me to make about who would be our guest on today's program. I still remember hearing this talk when she first gave it, and I'm here to tell you that it really blew me away. I didn't necessarily agree with everything she had to say at the time, but I can say for sure that some of the ideas she sets out in this talk can keep you chewing on them for weeks. So I hope it has the same effect on you today as it did on me back in 2003 in Berkeley, California at the Mind States 4 conference. We'll join the audience just as John Hanna's microphone cuts in during his introduction of the one and only Susan Blackmore, who tells us that consciousness isn't really what it seems to be.
She's written a book called The Meme Machine. She's also written a new book that's coming out in about a month or two, which is a textbook on consciousness. And I just wanted to say a little bit about how I met her. We went out to dinner at the Tucson Towards a Science of Consciousness conference, and we had a dinner, and she told me that she used to work in parapsychology research, and that she got sort of disenchanted with that after finding out that the person that she was working with or underneath was sort of skewing the results and cheating. And so she kept looking into it, and she really wanted, she was, you know, it's like Mulder's poster, I want to believe. She wanted to believe, but she, after she looked into it and looked into it more, she realized she just, you know, she was no longer a believer in parapsychology. And so when she told me that, I thought, oh, well, I have a story for you, but I have a story. So I'll tell you the story that I told her, which was that one night my father was having a dream. I also have an older brother. So my father was having a dream, and in his dream he was walking up to a gathering where there were a whole lot of people gathered around him. He couldn't really see what was happening, and so he sort of pushed his way into the front of the crowd, and he realized he was at a hanging. But he couldn't see the face of the person who was being hung. It was some public hanging. The face was sort of obscured. All of a sudden he woke up. The reason that he woke up was that my older brother, who was in the next room sleeping, was screaming. And so he thought, okay, well, I'll go in and see what's going on with my son. And so he goes in and asks him, well, what's wrong? And my older brother says, I just had a dream that I was being hung. And so, you know, that always stuck with me as sort of a strange thing. So I told this story to Sue, and Sue said, yes, well, you know, there's probably some number of people every night who have a dream that they're watching a hanging, and there's another number of people who have a dream that they're being hung, and although it's, you know, a coincidence, it certainly is within the realm of probability, and she left it at that. And so I thought, okay, well, that sounds reasonable, but what really the realization I had was, oh my God, this poor woman. Every time somebody tells her, you know, every time she says that she doesn't believe in parapsychology anymore, somebody tells her like some half-baked story like mine, but no, but you must believe because, you know, my dad had this dream and it was so real. So I felt very sorry for her. And so I thought, well, what can I do to make it up for her? So I asked her to come here and flew her in. And anyway, she's great. You'll get to know her a little bit more. She's moderating as well and being the MC for the event. So Susan Blackmore.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Well, what can I say after that? Yes, please don't tell me any stories of that kind. You will see my eyes glaze over and I will fall dead at your feet. Please talk to me about something more interesting. We got plenty of interesting things happening here, haven't we? Now, you, are you conscious? Sure? He's pretty damn sure. What about you? Are you conscious? Yes, you are. Are you? You're semi. Only semi. Okay, well, that's a slight advantage. Now, is there anyone who's not conscious? Yes, you're not. Excellent. We got two or three. How do you know? Yeah. You don't know. Okay. Now, you, are you conscious? While I've been doing that, you probably have become what feels like more conscious. Because just asking the question, are you conscious now, does something rather peculiar. It makes you kind of go, and become aware of a whole lot more stuff. Were you conscious before I started that? What about you? You get this sense that a moment ago you weren't, and now you've become... Any of you recognize what I'm talking about? Yeah? It's very peculiar, isn't it? There are many peculiar things about consciousness. That's just one that I happen to pick on. Is it doing something? Now, scientists at the moment have woken up to the fact that there's a huge problem here. Most of the last century, people were just sort of not really allowed to talk about it. Now you get an awful lot of neuroscientists, psychologists, philosophers saying things like this. It's the most important problem in the biological sciences. It's the last surviving mystery. It's one of the most baffling problems in science. It really is. This is really exciting. You know, a lot of people kind of think that scientists like myself are kind of pushing the problem away. Some are, but there's a huge excitement about what we do with this mystery. And it's a very strange mystery indeed. What is the mystery? Okay, I need something. Can somebody give me something to demonstrate a mystery with? Anything will do. Oh, yes, your hat will be lovely. Thank you. Excellent hat. Right, here is a hat. Yes, we agree there's a hat? Now, do you think there's a real hat here or some object, like a real physical thing? Yes? Yeah? Okay, it's made of molecules or whatever people tell you it's made of, yeah? Now, are you having an experience of seeing this hat? Yeah? Yeah? That's the only way you can perceive it. Of course you're having an experience. Like, yes, you're laughing, I know. But you're having an experience. The color of this hat, how does it look to you? I mean, how it looks to you, is that the same as how it looks to him? You can't ever know, can you? It's an old philosophical problem. Probably as kids, you went round and round that one and didn't get anywhere. But the point is, there's two different things here. Your experience of the hat, which is private and subjective and yours alone and nobody can know what it's like. That's what we mean by consciousness in contemporary science. What it's like for you. That's the definition. It's not really a definition. That's what we mean, what it's like for you. But we also think there's a real hat made of physical stuff. Now, you try getting away from that. Nobody's successfully got away from that. In the 1890s, it was called the Great Chasm or the Fathomless Abyss. It's the great chasm between mind and brain, the mind-body problem. It's the great chasm between the inner and the outer, the experience that I'm having and the hat I believe exists in the real world. It's the chasm between subjective, how it is to me, an objective how we believe it must be in the real physical world. Don't underestimate this problem. There are probably lots of you out there who, if you don't come and tell me stories about psychic phenomena, will tell me you've got a theory of consciousness that solves the problem. Well, if you have, you're a genius. Tell the world about it. It's a really difficult problem. It is not solved by having a kind of stuff called consciousness that hangs about somewhere. It's not solved by being a pure materialist and saying it's all stuff. It's not solved at the moment anyway at all. So, we can have fun with it. My talk is suggesting that consciousness is an illusion. Now, when people say consciousness is an illusion, if they're not thinking clearly about it, they think, I mean, it doesn't exist. That's not what I mean. Look up illusion in the dictionary, and it says, something that isn't what it seems to be. So that's the sense in which I'm going to use the word illusion. Something that, it really does exist, it's there, but it's not what it seems to be. Here's a very simple little illusion, rather nice one, isn't it? There's something there, there's a slide, there's a black and white drawing. It looks as though the chap at the top is bigger and more menacing and more frightening than the poor little chap running away at the front, doesn't it? But they are exactly the same size. My son drew it, and I watched him pick it up in whatever he was using, paint shop or something, and move it, and it's exactly the same. Funny, isn't it? So that's the sense in which I mean consciousness might be an illusion. Not what it seems to be. What is it? What is it? Well, what does it seem to be? Let's think for a minute about how it seems. How does it seem to you? Does it seem as though there's a you somewhere inside your head who is watching your experiences on your own kind of world screen, pulling the levers to control things, saying, I'm going to move my arm, I'm going to move my legs, and because I say so, it happens. Is that how it feels? Anyone put up their hands if it feels a bit like that? Pretty brave of you, about a quarter of you say, I mean, surely it feels like that. It still feels like that to me, and goodness knows I've practiced trying to make it not feel that way, but it feels that way, as though I'm in here looking out. Somehow I'm in here looking out through the eyes. It feels that way. Maybe it is that way. But let's start from at least that feeling. If any of you genuinely don't feel that way, it's very interesting. There are some people who've got out of that. There are some people who never seem to get into it. Some of you probably blown your minds out of it completely. But that's the kind of common view. Now, this is called by the American philosopher Dan Dennett, the Cartesian theater. Have any of you read Dan Dennett's book, Consciousness Explained? Oh, wonderful, about 20 of you. This is where he explains the Cartesian theater. It's this idea. Cartesian from Descartes. Now, Descartes believed in the separate mind and body. Dennett is not talking about that. Why he calls it Cartesian is simply because it has this idea of there being somebody in there. And that's what he calls the Cartesian theater. There's somebody in here who's experiencing stuff. The stuff comes into consciousness, and it's kind of in some mythical place, mythical time, where it all happens, and things become conscious, and then they go out of consciousness again. That's the theory he calls the Cartesian theater. And of course, he says, it can't be like that. It really, really can't. Could I have a brain for a minute, please? Could I have your brain? Could you just stand up here, please? Thank you. Right, I'm just going to cut this head open along the parting here. Well, you can't see, but I can see inside. And all I can see is a whole lot of brain cells. No? Thank you. That'll do. I'll put it, sorry. Okay. Hundreds and hundreds and thousands of brain cells all connected to each other, all firing, and, you know, there's no middle. There's no special hole where, you know, consciousness happens. There's no place for the me. In fact, there isn't a center at all. Things don't come into the middle and go out. There isn't a middle. They're all just... That's just one of the many reasons why Dennett rejects the idea of the Cartesian theater. He says, when you discard Cartesian dualism, that's Descartes' idea of separate mind and body, or a soul and a body, two separate things. When you discard Cartesian dualism, you must discard the show that would have gone on in the Cartesian theater and the audience as well. for neither the show nor the audience can be found in the brain, and the brain is the only place that is to look for them. Now, you might try looking somewhere else. You might not agree with him that the brain is the only place to look, but it's certainly the place to start, because we know that if you do strange things to brains, it changes the experience. So, he goes on to say that if you believe that in the Cartesian theater, you are a Cartesian materialist. Putting it even more strongly, if I say, what is in your consciousness now? Can you answer? Do you think that there is an answer, though? Yeah. Okay, so the feeling I think many of you may have is something like this. If I say, what's in your consciousness now? You can't tell me, because that would sort of spoil it, but you think there must be an answer. Because, well, doesn't it feel that way? Yeah, it feels that way. Okay, then you're a Cartesian materialist. You believe that there's such a thing as being in consciousness. Some things are in consciousness and some aren't. That's the normal way of thinking about it. Right? Okay. I think I agree with that. That's most of the time how it seems. Most of the time. That's also the way most current theories of consciousness have things. I won't go on about current theories of consciousness. There are lots of them. But this is an example of very popular what's called global workspace theories. And they talk about there being this kind of working memory space into which information comes, and then it goes out again. And when it's in there, it's in consciousness. It's like being lit up by the spotlight of attention. And then when it leaves, it's... Is that me, that noise? What am I doing? Oh, please fix me. I'm going to get fixed. Well, I'll try. I can't stand still. It's too difficult. So, don't worry about these theories. My point really is just that the majority of neuroscientists who talk about consciousness are what Dennett would call Cartesian materialists. They're looking for the way in which things come into consciousness and go out again. They're trying to understand the neural correlates of consciousness. They're trying to understand when you have an experience of seeing that, what sort of hat would you call it? Beige hat, I don't know, khaki hat. They want to know which of the bits in the brain firing that makes you conscious. It's bizarre. It's really difficult. How can firings of neurons, this is called the hard problem of consciousness, how can firings of neurons be your experience of that hat? Huh? How can they? And yet we know when you stop the firings, the consciousness goes away. There's got to be, but it's a mystery. Anyway, that's the sort of theory which is basically still Cartesian materialism. It still has the idea of a place into which things come, or a kind of firing or something that makes things conscious, and the rest are not. The problem is deep and difficult. Rather than try and have flow diagrams like that one I just showed you, and theories that say this bit produces consciousness, I'm going to have having some fun instead. So, I need you all to help me. Would you please all hold out your hand in front of you? And then... No, put your hands down. Sorry, I want to ask you a question first. Sorry. Oh, you're so obedient. It's wonderful. All right, I'm going to ask you a question first. Do you believe in free will? Excellent. We got a real believer. By free will, I mean the idea that you can consciously and deliberately decide to do something of your own free will without being coerced by anybody and then do it. Okay, hands up who believes in that, free will. That looks like a large majority. Let's have a hand show of those who don't. Okay, that's about maybe a tenth or so. Okay, fine. Right, now we're going to all use our free will, okay? Could you please hold out your arm in front of you? I know this is a trivial task, but I can't get you to do something really, you know, deep and meaningful. Well, I could, but I don't think I will. Whenever you feel like it, of your own free will, just go like that. I want you to keep doing this for a bit. I'll shut up and let you do it. And just feel the experience of doing it of your own free will whenever you feel like it. You might not do it at all of your own free will. It's up to you. Okay, you've got the feel of that. You can do it, can't you? Now, this was precisely the task set in perhaps one of the most famous experiments ever in consciousness studies by Benjamin Libet, who worked here in San Francisco. And he worked with neurosurgeons, and he did a whole range of experiments on the timing of conscious experiences. And this particular one was an experiment on what he called spontaneous voluntary action. Now, what he did was he got people to do exactly what I've asked you to do, to hold out their arm, and then whenever they felt like it, just to flex their wrist. And he got them to do this for quite a long time, an average of about 40 times each, so that he could get enough data to record things. Now, what was he going to record? The question in his mind was this: what starts the action? Is it a brain event that starts it? Or is it your consciousness that starts it? How could you find out? Well, you've got to find out the order in which these things happen, the order in which your conscious decision to act happens, and that the time when your conscious decision to act happens, and the time when the first brain event happens. So here you see what he's doing. The subject has electrodes on the wrist that will measure the exact time to the nearest millisecond when the hand moves. Then he has an electroencephalogram on his head that measures the brain events and will detect what is called a readiness potential in the motor cortex. The part of the brain controlling motor activity builds up activity for about nearly a second, about 900 milliseconds, nearly a second before the movement, you can begin to see activity, and it starts to build up, and then the action happens. That was already known before he did the experiments, but then he wanted to time the time at which the person spontaneously and of their own free will decided to act. How do you time that? Well, the way he did it was to have a spot revolving on a screen. So I'm going to be a spot revolving on a screen, right? Now, what the subjects had to do as the spot went round was after they acted, they had to shout out, tell him where the spot was when they decided to act. So if it was here, am I doing this clockwise? Is that clockwise? Okay, so if it's here, they shout one. If it's here, they shout three. If it's here, they shout six. Am I doing this right? And if it's here, they say nine, and so on. You get the idea? Okay, now I want you to be subjects, please. Hold out your arms again. And then when you spontaneously and of your own free will decide to act, just shout out where the spot is, okay? Okay, good. You can do it, can't you? Yeah? I mean, it's quite tricky, but you get the idea. It is quite possible. The reason I get you to do it is because a whole lot of people argued that they're not really doing it in RIRA. But, I've done it lots of times. People can do it. Now, the point is, it doesn't really matter when you shout. The timing is, what you are really doing is saying, when it happened, that's when it happened. It doesn't matter that there's a delay in when you shout out, because you say three, by then it's gone on, but that doesn't matter, okay? So that's how he timed the moment of will. He called W. So which do you think comes first? Will or the readiness potential? It certainly does. The readiness potential comes a long way first. Here you see the time at which the muscle moves. Here is the moment of will, 200 milliseconds before the action. And right back here, that's a different experiment, right back here at minus half a second is the readiness potential. You can see the readiness potential building up in someone's brain a long time in brain terms, before they know they're going to spontaneously and freely act. We should have known that. You all shouted out readiness potential. I mean, if you take a kind of naturalistic view of what's going on in the brain, it's got to be that way. But all hell broke loose in the psychology community, endless arguments, because it just doesn't fit with people's ordinary beliefs about free will. Now, there are lots of different interpretations of this experiment. many people said the results are false. That's the reason I got you to do this, because most of the arguments said that in one way or another people can't do it, or the timing doesn't work or something. It's possible to say that. I'm not going to go into all those arguments. I'm convinced, as much as I can be, that the results are valid. The interpretation is very difficult. You can say no, but as my friend Richard Gregory says, sorry, I should not have put that yet, but I'll take it away again. What Libet himself said was, you can't consciously start an action because it builds up in the brain first, but you can consciously veto it. You can stop it before it happens. Now, I had a wonderful time talking with Libet about this. We went to Golden Gate Park and wandered around and talked about this. And what he was really getting at, I think, was, in the end, was something like that to do with moral responsibility. Because these results seem to threaten the idea that we're really responsible. But he said, well, you can be responsible because you can stop things. So you're not responsible for having thoughts of murdering somebody or raping them or something, you know. But you are responsible for not stopping if you don't stop those thoughts. That was his kind of interpretation. And as Richard Gregory said, that means that we don't have free will, but we do have free won't. You can believe that if you like. Many people agree with Libet. It seems a little bit of a bodge-up to me. But what else can we believe? We can believe that free will is an illusion. That's my preferred solution. I don't want to press it on you, but it seems this way. When you look at these results, and many other results too, consciousness just doesn't seem to be the thing that starts things off. If you think that free will has to be to do with conscious free will, then that's definitely the way it seems, but perhaps it is not like that. So it's an illusion in the sense that I explained before. But things get a little bit more complicated still. Dennett would say, oh dear, I forgot I got this one in here. This is from Daniel Wegener, who's done lots of experiments on free will. And he's done experiments which show, for example, what gives somebody the feeling that they've got free will. And it turns out that you can do a lot of experiments where people are absolutely convinced that they've done something when actually the experiment has manipulated them. And his take on the illusion is something like this. What happens all the time, I think to myself, hey, that party sounds fun. It's $15 and it's be too late. I'll be in bed. But maybe I'll go. Maybe I'll. Oh, well, I think I will. Okay, I'll go to the party tonight. Now, and then, well, then I go. And I find myself there and I go, wow, I came here of my own free will. Now, what Wegener says is two things happen, and it happens all the time, hundreds of times every day probably. We have a thought that we're going to do something, and we do it. And we go, aha, my thought caused me to do it. But, he says, that's only the way it seems. How it really is that unconscious processes, like those measured by Libet, cause the thought, and other unconscious processes cause the action, and we have an illusion. We confuse correlation and cause, and we come to the conclusion that we have free will. So, there are many ways of believing that free will is an illusion. That's just one of them. But another possibility is that you simply can't time experiences. Dennett would say, if you say that consciousness comes too late, you're a Cartesian materialist. You're believing that there is a time at which things come into your consciousness. But what if that itself is wrong? Maybe the illusion is even deeper than we thought. I wonder if there's any way of getting some fresh air in here, because I can see, I can understand what I hope you're not yawning because I'm so boring. I hope you're yawning because it's hot. It's all right. I hear you. Any people in charge, can we open any doors or anything? Anybody know? Yes, excellent. Thank you, John. Oh, John's going to open a few doors or something. Okay. I am going to need somebody who doesn't mind being prodded with a sharp knife. Oh, we've got a volunteer up there who wants to be prodded with it. I'm also going to need a bare arm to prod. So, oh yes, you've got a nice T-shirt. You'll do absolutely fine. And you'll have some fresh air to waken you up when you've collapsed. Oh, there's the steps down around there. Now, I'm just going to do a little experiment. I must say that this experiment doesn't always work. When it works and the person lives, it's quite fun. But if it doesn't, forgive me. It's worth it just to have a go. God, he's really willing, isn't he? This
well,
is fun.
Well, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, can you just push that as far up as it will go? Now, I don't want you to see what I'm doing. Gosh, he's so obedient. Right, just stay like that. Now, I want you all to watch very carefully what I'm doing, all right? Are you ready? Are you ready, sir?
Yes.
Don't faint, will you? Okay, I'm ready. What did you feel? Where were they? Show us again where they were.
Something like...
Excellent, excellent. Thank you very much. Isn't he good? Some people describe it as a little animal running up, so it's called the cutaneous rabbit. There wasn't one here, and there wasn't one here. What you actually had was 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Strange, isn't it? Now, just stay there a minute. This is very peculiar. You were conscious of them, weren't you? Yeah. So, if you ask what was in consciousness when, let's have your arm again. Now, the real mysterious one is number 3. It went 1, 2, 3, right? But he feels number 3 here. Now, after this one has happened, how does he know which way it's going to go in order to feel number 3 there rather than, say, down here? It's like precognition. Oh, precognition exists after all. I was wrong all those years. I didn't say that. Now, what was happening? Maybe consciousness stores it all up and then replays it later so it can get it right. That doesn't sound very convincing, does it? Maybe it wipes it out. Maybe you were conscious of it being here and there, but then afterwards you did some kind of funny thing in the brain and replayed it as though it was all there. Could it be like that? Whatever you do, whichever way you try and play it, it does seem very peculiar. It seems like you're just trying to solve the problem in some post hoc kind of way. Thank you. Thanks very much. I think he deserves a round of applause, don't you? Right. I am going to show you a picture for a very brief length of time. You've seen it already briefly, but it doesn't matter. You can have another go. And I just want you to look as quickly as you can and take in as much as you can, all right? Oh, bleh. Stay. What did you see? Somebody put their hand up and tell me what they saw. What did you see? A guy with horns and scores. Just one? Just one, okay, there's something funny with his eyes. What did you see? Okay, you saw several pictures. you saw several pictures, any idea how many? You saw 18 pictures and one of them had horns. Did everybody agree? Yes? You saw a whole lot of pictures and one of them had horns and a scar. Yes? Were all the pictures the same? Except for the one with the horns, okay? Now, what's so special about this? Well, that is indeed what was there. That is Dan Dennett, who some people call the devil. And my son, who did all these pictures for me, said, oh, can I put horns on him? And I did ask Dan, and he said it's fine. There are, in fact, 18 of them, well counted. Now, you saw that for 3 seconds. You move your eyes about 4 or 5 times a second. So the maximum number of places that you can have looked in that time is 3 times about 15. Now, even if you systematically looked at each one, you're unlikely to have seen, well, you couldn't have seen all of them, but you won't have done that because you picked on the one with horns and had a good look at that. Now, we know from our understanding of the visual system, been known for 100 years, that you can only see in high-resolution detail with the very middle, with the fovea. So it's when you're actually looking at one spot on that picture, let's say you look here at Dan's nose, which is quite likely where you do look, in the time that you're on there, about a fifth of a second, about that much will be in focus and the rest of the picture will be a blur. There is no way that you can have looked in detail to be sure that all those pictures are the same. If there is any such thing as being in consciousness, you cannot have got those all in there. And yet you say with confidence, and you're right, that there are 18 identical pictures of Dan Dennett, one of which has horns on. What's going on? This amazing information gathering system of your brain is gathering enough information to come to that conclusion, and that's a right conclusion. And it's particularly spent some time on the horns. It has pop-out detectors. These are special mechanisms which find differences and just draw your eye to those differences. So if you get a uniform picture with something different, your eyes will naturally go there by this unconscious attentional mechanism. So you have an illusion that all of this stuff was in your head. We know it can't be. Now, I've got a few other ways of showing you a similar, coming to a similar conclusion. When you look around the world, do you get this idea that you kind of build up a picture like this? As you look around, you're building up a bigger and bigger picture. Yeah? You kind of, as you look around this room, you're gathering the information until it builds up a proper picture in your head. That's how it seems, doesn't it? That's the kind of theory that psychology's been working on, and cognitive science and artificial intelligence have been working on for a long time. That we build up a picture in our head with every saccade as we look around. Because what we are experiencing is the picture in our head. That's what's in consciousness. Now, if that were true, then it would be the case, I think, that if you were looking around this room, say, and something really big changed, you'd notice it. Because you've got a rich and vivid picture in your head of this room. Right? Now, as you move your eyes around, you think, of course I'd notice if some big thing changed. So I want you to look at some pictures. I'm going to show one version of a picture and then another version of the picture, and something is going to change. Now, some of you will see it straight away, so don't shout out what it is. And spoil it for the other people. See if you can see what changes. Hands up if you can see what's changing. Hands up if you can't see. You're the interesting ones. Some of them are going down. Okay, hands up if you can't see two things that are changing. Right, keep looking. The hands are going up and down and all over the place. There are two quite big things changing. Okay, tell them. It's the lamp and the keyboard. Now, it's a very strange phenomenon. I'm sorry, with this laptop and this setup, the timing isn't quite right, so this isn't perfect. I'm sorry about that. But it's a very strange phenomenon. It's called change blindness. It's been very well documented over the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. I did the first experiment on this in about 95. Dan Dennett had come across earlier experiments just before that. And we now know that you can have enormous changes. Here's one experiment that's not mine. See if you can see what this happens in this one, what's changing here. Hands up who can't see it. Oh, lots of you can't see it. That's much better than my silly picture that I took myself in there. Oh, they're going down, they're going down. You've seen it. Okay, shout out for them. It's the bar at the back. Now, Dan Simons did this experiment for a particular reason, to show that the change can be right in the middle of the picture and you still don't see it. Now, if you think you have a rich and vivid and complete picture in your head, in your brain, you ought to see it. It suggests that you do not have such a picture. Whatever you do have, it's not that. You do not have a rich and vivid picture of the world in your head. So when important people like Francis Crick, you remember Watson and Crick, who discovered the double helix, the structure of DNA, Francis Crick is studying consciousness. He is looking for the neural correlates of the vivid representation in the brain of the scene before us. But it looks like there is no such thing. That's how difficult consciousness studies is. I think people are looking for something that doesn't exist. Damasio talks about the movie in the brain. Same argument. But things are even worse than this. I would like to show you a video now, if my video person is ready for this. This is quite complicated because we've got to switch over from one computer to the other, so let's hope that this will work. Now, you have a very important task to do. What you're going to see is a whole lot of American students. Oh, I'm in America, I shouldn't say that. A whole lot of students playing around with a ball. They're throwing the ball around. There are two teams, the white team and the black team. You must concentrate on the white team, and I want you to count the number of times the ball is passed from the white to white. So just watch the white team and count the number of passes, okay? If anyone has seen this before, please don't shout out the right answer, because I want everybody to do their own counting, all right? So as soon as we get this ready, get ready to count. Watch the white team and count the number of times they pass the ball. Watch the white team. Just the white people count the number of times they pass the ball to each other. Keep counting, keep counting. Okay. Right, how many did you see? How many times did they pass it? Shh, okay, let's have one at a time. And shut up, all you nuisance people. How many? 17. Okay, hands up, how many saw 17? Hands down. Who saw 16? Hands down. Who saw 18? Hands down. Who saw something completely different? Who saw another number? 15. Okay, fine. Who saw anything else?
Gorilla.
Gorilla? You saw a gorilla? Did anybody not see a gorilla? Who didn't see a gorilla? You didn't see the gorilla? No. Would you please play it again, Sam? You didn't see the gorilla? What sort of an audience are you? Didn't see the gorilla, I don't know. Very small gorilla in the corner? Perhaps it's a tiny gorilla down here? Perhaps it peeps out of the lift when you're not looking. Well, don't clap me, clap Dan Simons. This was his film. It's what's called inattentional blindness. If you don't pay attention, you don't see it. What does that say? Shh. What does that say about what's in your consciousness? What does that say about the idea that I'm in here and I'm experiencing this rich world out here, that right now I am conscious of this room? I don't know what it says about it, but it certainly says something a bit strange and a bit worth thinking about. I've no idea. I think it's 17, but so one day I'll sit down and count it properly. People usually get a widespread like you did. Sorry, I really should know the answer. People don't even usually care about that after they've seen the gorilla. Now, what really interests me about this, I have used here some experiments, you know, scientifically carried out experiments on people, but what I want to do with that is to think, well, what's wrong with my view of the world? Because even though I know all this, I'm still stuck in the Cartesian theater. I can't quite get away from the idea that I'm conscious of all this now. It can't be true that all this is in my consciousness, but what is it like really? Surely I know what it's like, if anybody does, don't I? Or maybe I don't. Maybe I need to look. Maybe I need to be able to see more clearly. William James, one of my great heroes, he wrote The Principles of Psychology in 1890. Who's read that? Oh, well done. It's two volumes. It's 1,100 pages altogether, but it's a fantastic book. But he said that introspective analysis in cases like this is like trying to seize a spinning top to catch its motion, or trying to turn up the gas quickly enough to see how the darkness looks. I love that, don't you? Turn it up, quick. He'd have loved electricity, wouldn't he? You could do it even quicker. The modern equivalent is it's like trying to look in the fridge to see whether the light's always on. I keep doing it. Can I catch myself not being conscious? If I look quick enough, if I blink, can I catch myself out, not having the illusion of it all being here? How can I get out of it? It's got to be an illusion. I'm not going to be happy with the idea there's a soul or a spirit or a conscious phenomenon or some kind of dark or quantum mechanical theories of consciousness. They don't help. Somehow, I want to be able to see my way out of this directly. Perhaps it's something like this, that rather than there being things that are in consciousness, every time we look, every time we ask ourselves, am I conscious now? Or every time I asked you at the beginning, are you conscious now? Oh, always the answer is yes. You never catch yourself saying no, do you? Because at that moment of asking the question, a backward stream is concocted. You look back and pull it like with the thing on the arms. So you always seem to be being conscious. What about the rest of the time? And how can we look? One way, William James took, and many other people. He took nitrous oxide and became convinced that the world was made of thoughts. Many other people have said the same. Nitrous oxide turns you into an idealist. How wonderful that your whole philosophy can be changed by a little molecule with, you know, three atoms. And there are plenty more interesting molecules as well, as I expect you know. There are other ways too, perhaps more arduous, and maybe we need more than just a quick fix. Maybe we have to take some time. And I'll just tell you a very famous story some of you may know. I'm interested in Zen, and it's a Zen story. And it's a story about Huineng, who was the sixth patriarch of Chan, Chinese Zen. And he was very, very famous, and he had his monastery in the mountains. Of course, I'm making half of it up. This is my words of the story. But there is Huineng in his monastery, and one day along comes a monk who's been traveling for days to come and see the famous master. And he gets there, exhausted, thinking, oh my God, the master's going to be so frightening, etc. And the master says to him, well, hello, monk, what's your name? And he tells him, and where have you come from? He says, oh, I've come from the mountain over such and such. Did you have a good journey? How was the weather? Are you tired? How are your feet? And the monk answers, this isn't very nice, this master. And he answers all the questions. And then Huineng says to him, and what is this thing that has thus come? And how did it get here? And the monk doesn't know what to say. So he stays in the monastery. And he sits, and he looks, and he looks into, what is it? What is this? What is this thing that has come? How did this get here? How did this get here? And he looks for 8 years. And eventually he goes to the master and he says, Master, I have had a little awakening. And the master says, what is it? And he says, well, to say that it's like something is to miss the point. Ah, good, says the master. But it's not like anything. Remember, the definition of consciousness is what it's like to be. If it's not like anything, can it still be trained, cultivated? And the monk says, oh, yes, it can, and gets on with his practice. What did he see? What does anybody who see who wakes up? I have no idea whether this is about the same kind of thing that I've been talking about. But I suspect it might be. And so I want to look too. But I don't know what I will find when I do look. And I'm not going to give you any answers. I'll just leave you to wonder for yourself whether perhaps this is all a grand illusion. Thank you. We have Since I was told I'm allowed to have the time I was originally allotted, we got about 10 minutes for questions. So back there, thank you. Oh, yes, I'm sure that that's why it worked. Sorry, I'll repeat the question. His question was, with the gorilla video, how important is it that you're given an explicit direction not to pay attention to black forms? That is certainly necessary. If I just showed you that video and said, just watch this video, then afterwards you would report back to me that you saw lots of people throwing a ball and a gorilla walking through. I have to do it quite strongly, and not so strongly as to put you off, and I have to do something to stop the people laughing, and some of you did laugh, you rotters, but it didn't spoil it, thank goodness. Because if I say don't laugh, then, you know, anyway. It depends crucially on that. But that doesn't change the main point. That everybody wouldn't laugh if it weren't for the fact that you expect you ought to have seen it. And after this, I suggest that you walk around, you know, when you're walking around in your ordinary life, just realize just how much you are not seeing. That you are not you're not seeing it all. You're seeing what you attend. It's more like experience. What is experience? I don't know. But it's more like it's this and a bit and a it. And it's not the continuous, solid, rich thing that we think it is. So I don't think it's spoiled by that. Okay, there's going to be an awful lot of questions. I'll have to deal with them as best I can. Yes. How much is the problem of consciousness to do with the fact that we're using particular kind of language to describe things like the cutaneous rabbit? Let's take the problem of language. There are some people who say, well, it's only in our Western culture that we have this problem. But this problem has been around a long, long time. In ancient Greek philosophers and many other philosophical systems, you have various kinds of breakdowns of that lead you into dualism. And they depend on which culture you're in, what the dualism is. And in our own philosophical tradition, it shifted. The traditional mind-body problem was really about the body. It got kind of shifted to the brain as we learned more about it. And most people are now happy to think of the body as a mechanism, which Descartes really started, but they're not happy to think of the brain that way. But it's now shifted to the hard problem, which is to do with neural firings. It keeps shifting, and it's different in different philosophical traditions, but it's always a kind of tendency to dualism. And even in Buddhism, which I talked about at the end, one of the main kind of objectives is to see non-duality. So I think that it isn't just a question of the language we use and the particular experiments we do. They may make the specific way we go about it, but the problem, I think, is fundamental in human experience. I can't say that for sure, but that's how it appears to me. Yes. Good question. It's a question about the relationship between hallucinations and what we're all seeing now. So if we all were to think of this as a tree, would you please think of this as a tree? All of you, right together now, think of this as a tree. Okay? And our question was, is this the same as our experience of the real world? Well, we can say in terms of what's going on in the brain, it's very similar. When you imagine a tree, it sets off firing in the same parts of the visual cortex that are set off when you see a tree. And this has actually been done with brain scans. It was suspected for a long time, and we know it's true now. But you will find that if you're looking at a real tree, you've also got information going through the optic nerve, through the lateral geniculate, and through visual areas that are not there when you try and imagine it. So there's that difference. But the real clincher of a difference is this. If I ask everyone about their tree, they will all have different kinds of trees. I'll see a willow tree, but you'll see an oak, and you'll see some mythical tree with orange leaves. And we can't do experiments on it. But this thing, you know, I can tell you, if I ask you what's going to happen when I go like this, you'll say, my foot will hit it and it'll make a noise, and it does. And that throws us right back into the problem, that there really does seem to be a difference. And I don't know how you get out of that. Yes. What do I think is happening in déjà vu? Well, I don't know what's happening in all déjà vu. There may be some cases where people get this great sense of, this has happened before, I know what's going to happen next, and they really do. But we know certain things about déjà vu. First of all, people who have temporal lobe epilepsy quite often get déjà vu as part of the aura. And we know exactly where it happens. It's in the temporal lobe, about here somewhere. And there is a specific part of temporal lobe that you can stimulate artificially, either with electrodes on the skull or using TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, and you can force an experience of déjà vu. And it is called inappropriate sense of familiarity. What it seems to be is that you've got a familiarity detector that looks all the time, is looking at stuff and telling, giving some kind of a message as to how familiar things are. And that can, under certain circumstances, just, you know, fire when it shouldn't. And you get this huge sense of I know, I've been here before. But you haven't. As I said, there may be cases where people can actually predict, but there's none that I know of, because usually it's too quick. By the time you know that, it's already happened. And people get this sense of having dreamed, maybe I dreamed it before, but I think that's because you can't place it. You don't know how to put it in, was it yesterday? It's a bit hazy, so it's a dream. So I think certainly the vast majority and possibly all deja vu experiences are that. You. Yes. His question is, taking Libet's experiment on the hand moving, have there been experiments with more complex actions? Because he's quite right in implying this is a pretty tedious and boring thing. You know, when you think of free will, you do not think of twitching your hand, you know. You think of things like taking important decisions in your life. And important decisions in your life can't be done very easily in experiments, so those haven't been done. But he then said, what about something like playing squash? Or personally, I play ping pong, and that's, you know, it's very fast. And obviously, it's absolutely clear you're reacting much faster than you can possibly be conscious of it. You're conscious of playing the game, whatever that means, and I really don't know what that does mean. But there's no question about it, you cannot consciously see the ball coming towards you in time for it to sort of come into consciousness, and then you respond and do it. But it's also known that there are two streams in the visual system, the ventral stream and the dorsal stream. And it looks like one leads to the perception of objects and the knowledge that you're playing ping pong and all of that, and the other simply controls, and controls the fast actions. You can separate these out, and some people have brain damage to one or the other, and they can still do these fast things. People with that kind of brain damage can say they can't see anything at all, but they can grasp it like that. Quite extraordinary. So that's a partial answer to your question. I think I'm just going to take two more questions, and then we'll have to stop. You back there with a... Yeah. No, I probably slightly slurred them there because there's a tendency of people who talk about the two visual streams to say that the perception stream is the conscious stream and the action stream is the unconscious stream, and I don't think that's valid. But I suppose the sense in which I meant it was that the kinds of things that you report being conscious of are the sort of things which you have perceived in the sense of recognizing them as objects or knowing their faces or that kind of thing. So I'm sorry I'm being a bit loose there with the terms, and I should be more careful with people who know something about this. We'll take one more question. You right at the back there. I'm sorry to all the others. I do apologize. Is looking for conscious... I can see some of you like that question, so it's a good thing that I'm forced into answering it. Isn't looking for consciousness in the brain like looking for the TV station inside the TV set? No, I don't think it's like that at all. That, I think, is part of the same kind of illusion. It's such a popular idea, this, that somehow consciousness is out there, and this is the transmitter that is kind of bringing it in. It's an idea that I once found enormously attractive. Bergson in 1911 wrote a wonderful book of that kind. It was about the limitations. The brain is actually limiting consciousness. Actually, it's all there, and we're just filtering it through the sort of selection. I love this idea. In fact, it's one of the ideas that set me off doing my PhD, which was on extrasensory perception as a cognitive process, and I had a whole theory about this, of that kind. I think there are a lot of reasons why that it's not like that at all, but one of them is simply that if you really start looking in a television with the best science you have available, you'll pretty soon work out that there's a signal coming in, and that when there isn't a signal coming in, you can't see a picture, and you pretty soon solve it. Now, it is possible that we'll find something like that in the brain, but as we learn more and more and more, we're beginning to understand all the interactions, and we know if you put a drug in here, it changes it. We know if you cut this bit out, you lose that. It just doesn't look that way to me. It may be, but I don't think so. And we'll have to leave it there.
As much as I'd like to begin kicking around some of the issues that Susan raised in this talk, I'm going to leave that to interacting with any comments you might want to leave on our Notes from the Psychedelic Salon blog, which you can find at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And before I go any farther, I want to be sure to thank the kind donors who are supporters of this program, and in particular, Veeple P., O. Steve, David R., and Donald S. And to you and to all of the previous donors, supporters, guests, and friends of these podcasts who I was in the middle of some form of phone or email correspondence with, but recently seem to have dropped off the face of the earth, well, what can I say other than the man burns in only 29 days? So my days are now being consumed with constant trips to the hardware store and lumberyard in a desperate attempt to rebuild my shade structure that was destroyed in one of the big windstorms last year. And by the way, I'm looking forward to the fact that there are quite a few saloners coming to Burning Man this year, including Mallory and Max, who will be coming from Alaska to experience their first burn, and my old friend Fernando, who's coming all the way from Italy. I think the last time Fernando and I were together in person was back in 99 in Palenque, which was also the year that Terrence McKenna made his last appearance at that conference. And that leads me right up to the other part of my excited anticipation about this year's burn, and that is what our Palenque Norte microcamp will be doing. However, before I get to that, there are a few emails from fellow saloners that I want to be sure to mention. And I know that some of you aren't really all that interested in what must by now seem like the cult of Burning Man, and if you want to follow that line of thought a bit further, you might want to go back and re-listen to podcast number 3, where Eric Davis, in one of the very first Palenque Norte lectures, spoke about the cults of Burning Man. But now, as they say on Monty Python, but now for something completely different. First of all, I want to congratulate Bruce Damer and his team of 3D creators at the Digital Space Commons. You'll remember Bruce from podcast number 47 and number 85. And Bruce, by the way, is also the person who interceded with Ralph Abraham to obtain all of the Trialogue tapes for us. In fact, last November, when I was staying with Bruce and digitizing the Trialogues, we recorded what still will eventually become the first in a new series of podcasts I'm going to begin later this year. And I guess I should kick myself now for being so slow to get it out, because it would have been a great scoop now that Bruce is on the front page of many tech newspapers, even made it to USA Today and others like that. If you follow the adventures of spaceflight, then you already know what I'm talking about, but in case you missed it, Bruce and his team have become what I think may be the very first group of futurists to have NASA buy into their proposal for a major repositioning of thought about the near future of space missions. I won't go into all of the details right now, but the headline is something like, Bruce Damer and the Digital Space Commons designed the new NASA mission and spacecraft. How's that for a headline? And you can read some of the exciting news about this, one of our fellow saloners, through a series of links on the main Digital Space Commons website, which is at www.digitalspace, all one word, digitalspace.com. So, congratulations to Bruce, Galen, and the entire VR 3D team at the Commons. Bravo, you guys. And when I eventually get the first of the Matrix casts out with my late-night chat with Bruce about these things, it's going to be kind of fun, I think, to see how a late-night's dream can sometimes materialize. At least as long as there's some daytime work that gets done on it as well. Now, recently I've received a surprising number of emails from fellow saloners who seem to confirm my hunch that if and when you're ready to get a little closer to the people and medicines our speakers are talking about, that they will actually find you. And each of these stories has its own unique twist, sort of like the one that came from Brendan. Here's what Brendan had to say. After listening to the latest podcast, I was just instantly jaw-dropped. I just had to write to tell you this little story. I really came to an instant sense of how small the world really is. Around last February or so, I was at my college attending a career fair of sorts. I was searching for summer opportunities in a field of studies which would allow me to do more research into shamanism. I really wanted to find a way down to Ecuador for a while, and to no avail. So I ended up leaving, not finding what I was looking for. As soon as I left the building to go to my next class, my eyes gazed across the campus through the trees blowing in the wind, and I immediately knew what I saw. a ceremony of sorts with a handful of courageous and open students and a guy dressed in white in an odd-looking hat. A shaman. I knew it was too good to be true. To make a long story short, I learned this shaman was from Ecuador. He came to me instead of me going to him. Now, Brendan's message goes on, but that's the kind of thing that seems to be happening to a lot of us these days. So I've begun to look at coincidences as clues, you know, clues that I'm on the right path. When the coincidences and synchronicities begin to taper off, at least for me, I find that it's time to check the direction I'm taking, because maybe I've drifted off what was once a well-marked path. Another email I want to be sure to mention comes from one of the many Jameses who join us each week. And he says, I just finished listening to Podcast 101. It was quite exciting to hear of an ayahuasca journey by someone around my age, and with a moniker James as well. But I just wanted to correct you, though, on the part at the end where you quoted from one of my emails to you. It's a great piece to be certain, but that is because it was refined over many nights by the late stand-up comedian Bill Hicks. I believe I mentioned that in the email, but I can't find it now. Regardless, I merely want to set the record straight and point you towards the very psychedelic, intelligent, and hilarious work of this great American comic, who sadly died in 1994. No doubt my fellow listeners picked up on this as well. Well, thanks for picking up on that, James, and yes, you did say in your email that it was from Bill Hicks, but I totally forgot to say that when I read the quote. And like many of our fellow Solaners, Bill Hicks is one of my favorite comedians, too. In case you haven't heard him, just go to the psychedelicsalon.org website, and in the left sidebar in the links to recent news section under the War on Drugs category, got all that? Well, I've added links to two Bill Hicks videos. One is a bit about drugs and evolution, and in the other he tells what he calls a positive drug story, which I'm sure you'll find amusing. So if you haven't heard the late, great Bill Hicks yet, well, maybe you owe it to yourself to check him out. And James ended his email by saying, hope Burning Man goes well for you. Well, thanks for that, James, and thanks for bringing up my current obsession, the 2007 Burning Man Festival. To begin with, if you want to hear what Alex Gray thinks about Burning Man, there's a great interview with him that was done at last year's event, and you can find that on Burncast number 28. And the Burncast, by the way, is a podcast that focuses exclusively on the Burning Man event. Now, what's up with Palenque Norte on the Playa this year? That's the question I started with last January as I was thinking back to the huge success we had in 2006 in the big tent provided by Cliff and the good people who built and financed in Theon Village. And if you were there, you know what I mean. Now, if I was a younger man, I might try to do something even bigger this year, but my current trajectory seems to be in the older direction, and so I no longer have this insane urge to compete with myself. Okay, let me just cut to the chase. I could simply point you to the webpage that I'm in the process of building with all of this information on it, but since this is a podcast and you most likely aren't sitting at your computer right now, I'm going to read a few of the things about our plans for this year's burn. And by the way, you can find this information along with more detailed plans as they evolve on my matrixmasters.com website. Right at the top of the home page, you'll find an obnoxiously big link to our 2007 Burning Man page. Unless, of course, you're listening to this podcast after sometime in September 2007, and then you can find a link to the final version of that page by following the Burning Man link at the very top of any MatrixMasters.com or PsychedelicSalon.org webpage, and that'll take you to our main Palenque Norte page where you'll find links to our schedule for every year since we began the Palenque Norte concept. First of all, here's the announcement that I put in the official Burning Man program that you'll get at the gate. From 3 to 6 p.m. on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday in the Yurt at the Pod Cluster, which can be found at 7:30 and Intertidal, the following will take place. Lorenzo, host of the Psychedelic Salon podcast, will be moderating a series of community discussions regarding issues relating to the theme of this year's burn, These discussions will be led by leading authors, artists, researchers, and futurists. A listing of the speakers, including days and times they will participate, will be posted at the Interactive Yurt Gallery in the Pod Cluster. And here's a little of what I say about it on the website. Topic leaders include Eric Davis, Daniel Pinchbeck, John Hanna, Preet Chopra, Rock, Raphael Eisner, Seabrook Leaf, Tom Patterson, Roberto Venosa, Martina Hoffman, and Valerie Mojeko, among others. And I also mention what may actually become the most memorable of this year's plialogues, and that is the potential for ad hoc plialogues. You see, in addition to the regularly scheduled plialogues, my co-host and I will be turning on our recorders and capturing plialogues all over Black Rock City. And if you don't see us on the playa, well, stop by the Planque Norte micro camp somewhere in the Pod Cluster at 7:30 and Intertidal, and join in the conversation with us. And who will my co-host be, you ask? Well, one of the frequent requests that I receive is to tell more about Burning Man, but from the perspective of somebody going for the first time. So what better way to do this, I figured, than to just ask a first-time burner to help with the plialogues. And since Burning Man is such a colorful event, I decided to ask for help from one of the most colorful people I know who is also planning on coming to his first burn this year. And that is the one and only Matt Palomary, or Mateo, as you may know of him from podcasts number 80 and 89. But on the playa, he may also be known by the handle I gave him a few years ago, and that's Casawack. More about that some other day. So come on by the Pod Cluster near 7:30 and Intertidal and stop by and say hello. And for the first few of you who mention it, our fellow saloner Justin, who is part of my new favorite rock group, Fav Ohm, whose song And Drifting Away I played at the end of podcast number 96 with Charlie Grobe. Well, anyway, Justin sent me a dozen or so copies of their CD titled Release, and I'm going to keep one for myself and give the rest away at Burning Man to the first few people who come up and mention Vav Ohm to me. So even if you don't have time to stop for a visit, well, come on by anyway and say hello. Matt Palomary is going to be in our camp, as will John Hanna himself, along with some other close friends that I'm sure you'll enjoy meeting. Now, as to the genesis of the Planque Norte plialogues, let me read again from the website I'm building. Long ago and far away, there gathered a small group of people in a Lacandon jungle near the ruins at Palenque, Mexico. Each year, for a couple of weeks, a few hundred inquisitive souls sat around the end of the pool at the Chan Ka Hotel and talked. They told stories and jokes, they sang, they danced, and they sat on their porches late into the night talking about their cosmic dreams. Those are great days, those lazy days around the pool in Palenque. But those days have moved on, and that little tribe gathers in Palenque no more. But their conversations never died. In fact, they can often be heard in various nooks and crannies of Black Rock City. In 2003, a few of us initiated the Planque Norte Conversations, which evolved into the Planque Norte Lectures by 2006. Now the time has arrived to return to our roots, conversations with the people we've been bumping into at conferences and festivals for many years now. Anyone who has attended a conference in the past, like Mind States or the Entheobotany seminars in Palenque, will tell you that while the speakers are what drew them to the conference, it was the people they met there that kept them coming back. So we are going to attempt to recreate that vibe at the end of the pool in Palenque and record a series of plialogues or group conversations on the playa. It is our hope that these conversations will eventually reach people far and wide. Hopefully our conversations will never end, but will reach the ears of all who are ready to listen. So that, my friends, is only the beginning of what I hope is in store for the plialogues. My hope is for you to continue them with your friends, relatives, neighbors, coworkers, and anybody else who shares an interest in exchanging ideas about better ways for us humans to get along and live on this beautiful little planet together. And I'm going to see if we can't figure a way to share them with each other in some way or another. Now, one more thing about the plialogues, and then I'll let you go for today. I want to be sure to give credit to Bruce Damer for coming up with the word plialogue. While I was working on the concept for this year's Palenque Norte contribution to the Playa, I kicked the idea around with a few other people, and Bruce was one of them. He instantly understood what I was trying to do, and he came right back with the suggestion that the word plialogue would apply to it. Well, for me, the coining of that word finally put into focus what I hope these conversations will become. And, of course, one of the nice things about that word is that, as of just now, when I Googled the word plialogue, P-L-A-Y-A-L-O-G-U-E, there were no hits. Zero. Bruce has coined a new word, at least according to Google, whose only comeback was, "Did you mean play along?" So I hope that we all someday play along together with a plialogue. Oh, and Bruce wants you to know that his invention of that word is, as he says, "With apologies and thanks to Terrence, Ralph, and Rupert." And before I forget it, my thanks also go out to John Hanna for producing the Mayan States Conferences, to JT for recording and editing today's talk, and of course to the one and only Susan Blackmore, who already has a large following among our fellow Solaners, and whose very interesting mind has given us so much to think about today. Before I go, I want to mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 2.5 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click on the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which of course you can find at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And if you have any questions, comments, complaints, or suggestions about these podcasts, well, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. And I guess I should mention that matrixmasters.com is also my personal website. Before I started podcasting, that was where I spent a lot of my online time. In fact, if you're interested, my book, The Spirit of the Internet, Speculations on the Evolution of Global Consciousness, is on that site for you to read in HTML format. And if I can ever remember to do it, I plan on putting it up online in PDF format for you to download for free. But since I started these podcasts, I haven't added a lot of new material to that site. But some of my essays are there, along with a brief resume or CV or whatever you call it, for those of you who are wondering about those kinds of things. However, my plan after Burning Man is to focus on two main channels of communication with you, in addition to the podcasts, of course. Since my email has become a little unruly, what I hope to do is to interact with you about these podcasts via the comments section under each one on the psychedelicsalon.org Notes from the Psychedelic Salon blog. And I'm going to think of those comments as the main form of electronic mail that I read each week. But for conversations about other topics, I hope to use some form of interactive blog that we'll set up on MySpace or someplace like that. Now, with all of this, plus the ongoing physical preparations required to survive Burning Man, it's very doubtful that you'll be hearing from me, either via podcast or via email, until sometime after I get back and decompress around the middle of September. If I get a little extra time and have the energy, I'll try to get one more podcast out before I leave for the Playa. But if I don't, you can bet on the fact that I'll be with you in spirit as we all listen to some of the other great podcasts on the net, like KMO's Sea Realm and all of the shows on the Cannabis Podcast Network, which you can find at www.dopefiend.co.uk. And there's links to those on our Psychedelic Salon blog as well. And by the way, I stopped by Lefty's Lounge, which you can find on the Cannabis Podcast Network. Stopped by the other day, so you might hear me over there too. But as the song goes, just because you don't hear from me, it doesn't mean I'm not thinking about you. And Jacques, Cordell, and Wells, my friends who make music under the name Chatul Hayuk, thanks again for the use of your music here in the salon, you guys. I really appreciate it. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.